Welcome to the First 10 Pages. I'm David Ferrier. My co-host is screenwriter Kia Wilkins, and our guest today, screenwriter Claire Phillips, who actually went to school with Kia. They both studied at AFTERS in Sydney, and now she's doing great things as a TV writer here in Australia. We do talk a lot about her background and career coming up before fully getting into this Oscar-winning debut from Michael Arndt. So let's get into it. If you want to get in touch, first10pod@gmail.com and on all your socials. And if you're feeling generous, a review on Apple Podcasts is always really appreciated. So if you're listening on your podcast app, if you give us a review, we will love you forever. I want to give a heads up. We did have a couple of issues, technical issues with Claire's Zoom link up on my end where I was recording, and there are one or two dropouts. I did try to cut them out as much as possible, but there are one or two still there. So I apologize in advance for that. Let's get into this, the first 10 pages of Little Miss Sunshine.
Cheryl, remember when Olive was runner-up in the regional Little Miss Sunshine? Well, the girl who won had to forfeit her crown. I don't know why, something about diet pills, but anyway. Now she has a place in the state contest in Redondo Beach.
We're going to California.
Okay, let's start again. Let's pretend none of that happened. Claire Phillips, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Why did you choose Little Miss Sunshine?
I chose Little Miss Sunshine because I think it actually goes back to when I was at film school with Mr. Keir Wilkins. When we had to apply, we were asked to pick three films that, you know, I don't know, we had to talk about three films that we really liked and why we liked them. And I picked Little Miss Sunshine. I didn't really think of anything of it at the time. I just kind of really, I thought it was funny. I thought it was you know, a really strong character-driven comedy. And obviously, you know, Michael Arndt went on to win Best Screenplay. Like, it's an incredible screenplay to read. But then sort of as I've gone on in my career, there's so much, I just keep coming back to it. There's so much about it that I really strongly relate to. I think, you know, the thematic of winners and losers and just trying to fit in and just trying not to be a loser in life is something that I think a lot of my work I come back to. And then also just that family. I mean, that's my family. That's, you know, it's just so strongly relate to those characters. So I think I'm Olive, you know, watching those beauty queens in that first scene. And I was like the little fat 7-year-old watching the beauty queens and knowing there was no way I was ever going to do that, but still like, maybe I could do it. I don't know. It always spoke to me.
It's a great, I'm really glad you chose this film. I had a similar relationship with it, and I think there's probably just something universal about the depiction of family in that film, that it's just so beautifully dysfunctional and chaotic. And but it was so revelatory to me, this film, as well. And I don't think I understood why either when I first saw it, and it's only when once, you know, going to film school and becoming equipped with the tools to actually analyze a film like that, and you and coming to appreciate that it's like a structurally perfect movie. And it is just, yeah, there's so much to love about it. And it's such a sort of you know, it's a film without a clear antagonist, and so many things that I don't know, just when I saw this film, I was like, oh, that's the kind of movie I want to write. How do I do that?
Yeah, how do I do that? And it's deceptively simple. Like, it seems like it's just this family hanging out, going on a road trip, but when you start to sort of break it down, it's like really, it's quite incredible how it's structured. And I also think, like, Meg LaFoe, who is an incredible screenwriter, talks with Screen Australia, she always talks about finding your thematic in your work and, you know, like, what is it, what are you as an artist and you as a writer trying to say through pretty much, you sort of start to realise you're kind of saying the same thing every time. And I think with a film like this, like, this is my ballpark. This is what I always end up talking about, essentially.
You two went to school together, and you just mentioned that you had to pick three films that spoke to you for whatever reason. Do you happen to remember what the other two were? And Kia, what were your three?
I don't remember having to do that, to be honest. I couldn't tell you what my three films were.
It was in the application. Hilariously, my other ones were No Country for Old Men, which I don't know what that says about me. And the other one, which Kia will appreciate, was Fight Club. And I didn't even realise that one of our lecturers at the time of application was one of the producers on Fight Club. So I just totally, it must have looked like I was just trying to get in there, but I literally thought like that. Yeah.
I bet you I would have written three films that were what I thought they wanted to hear. Like, they wouldn't have actually been my favourite films. I would have picked some real wankery, you know, whatever, Gus Van Sant flicks.
Garden State, 500 Days of Summer.
Definitely Garden State, I reckon.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So this screenplay was nominated for 4 Academy Awards. It won 3, including Best Original. Well, you've sort of already spoken to this, that this does... Has it directly inspired your work, or more thematically and broadly speaking?
I think both. I mean, there's so many American indie comedies that came out at that time that I think I continually go back to, like this film, 500 Days of Summer, Juno. It's just that real run in the 2000s of these really well-structured, really well-written films that, you know, really walk that line between comedy and drama really well. And I think that's definitely something that I keep coming back to. I also think, you know, another thing that I keep coming back to all the time is those characters are so deeply flawed and in so many ways unlikable, but you just love them so much. And I think in my work always I'm trying to figure out how to do that, because it's just, it's so much fun to hang out with.
Yeah. Well, I think Michael Arndt, who wrote this screenplay, kind of came out of nowhere somewhat, and, you know, has now gone on to write Toy Story 3 and Hunger Games and Star Wars, and is kind of one of the big heavy hitters. And he's, I love that you picked this, because he's had such an interesting journey as a screenwriter. So to talk a little bit about your journey to screenwriting. So most recently you've finished up on Royal Flying Doctor Service for 7.
Yeah, RFDS for Channel 7. So we just shot that last year. I was a script producer and I wrote 3 of the episodes. There's 8 episodes. We were shut down by COVID, so that was fun, and shot out in Broken Hill. I was heavily pregnant in Broken Hill shooting this show. It was quite the journey, but a really fun year. That's what I've just finished up doing.
I'm so curious, for a show like Royal Flying Doctor Service, so very specialist doctors and flying, can you tell me about the research that goes into writing a show like that?
So much research. That show, that was so tricky, because you had to sort of learn, you know, you had to be a doctor, you had to be a pilot, you had to, then it was completely specialized by how that worked through the RFDS. So we spent a lot of time speaking to lots of different experts, engineers, so many different people. Ian Meadows, who created the show with Imogen Banks, he is an incredible, he just has a brain for research. I've worked with him on other shows and he just has always researched everything to the nth degree. And I, coming into that show, I wasn't like that. I didn't necessarily research stuff like that. I mean, I wrote on Offspring and that was hilariously, you know, not a very well-researched show about obstetrics, essentially. Like, it was more about emotion and character, and that was always the priority. But for us, RFDS was so meticulously researched, and it just takes forever, and you just have to keep talking to people until you find the right person. And, yeah, that was a lot of research.
Do you also get, like, story ideas from talking to people who have worked for the RFDS? And there was this crazy time where a guy crashed his motorbike in the middle of nowhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of the stories that are in the series have actually been taken directly from people's stories. And a lot of – there's actually quite a number of them that we've taken. But, yeah, definitely. And you always say, would you mind if I use this story? Would you mind if I use this part? And we were really lucky. We worked really closely with the RFDS and they were really generous with what they were giving us, which was great.
I suppose a lot of the time it's I imagine for those people it can be quite rewarding or gratifying to see, you know, their work recognised even in fictional form. It would be a bit of a thrill, I imagine. So you probably get more people willing to offer up their stories. That obviously some stuff is out of bounds, but I imagine people are pretty generous with that stuff because it's cool.
Yeah, they are. And the other thing that's kind of interesting as you start to kind of go down the rabbit hole of doing lots of research is some people are really great at telling stories and other people are just not. And some people think something's really important And then you'd find like a little gem, like you find someone who just tells, who can tell these incredible stories and have, you know, all these stories to tell. And you're just like, oh my God, I need to go back and talk to you and all the time. And then there's other people that just kind of get lost, or you're trying to, you know, find out how something might happen, and you realize halfway through the conversation that they're actually starting to make up a story because they're trying to please you. And you're like, no, I just need the actual truth.
Give me the facts
of what happened. Yeah, not just the possibilities of what could happen. I just need the hard facts. So it's, you know, it's difficult to kind of discern what.
Or like they start, you mean like they almost sort of like start pitching in the middle of their story, like, well, you know, I had a gash and needed to see it, but you know what could, like, you know, maybe a wild dog came over it.
Totally. And like midway through,
you could use that.
Midway through, you have to be like, so is that something that would is that something that has happened? And they're like, oh, no. I just think it could happen. And you're like, oh, good.
I'm actually writing myself. Here's a pilot I wrote.
Yeah. Oh, you yeah, absolutely.
Not to go off on too much of a tangent, but. Nomadland, I don't know if you guys have seen that, but that just blew my mind because she went out and just found, you know, real people living in these places. And I don't know exactly what the process was, whether she interviewed them and then she sort of wrote that into a perfect story. But the delivery by non-actors in that film is just incredible. Like, it's too real to be scripted, like to not be their true story, but also it's so beautifully poetically constructed as a story. So she either found just naturally gifted storytellers, or she worked with them a lot to get it into a good shape. But that blew me away.
And I think that's the thing, like, that I've realized from talking to lots of people now and doing a lot of research, is I've really become a total convert to it, because I think there's so much detail and authenticity that you get from those stories that you wouldn't necessarily come up with as a writer. And it makes such a huge difference.
Totally. Yeah, I think authenticity is like, you just, that, I guess the longer you spend being a screenwriter as well, I find the less, you know, the smaller your world becomes. You're like, the people you're hanging out with day to day are other screenwriters and people in the industry, and you actually have to actively go out and seek, you know, other perspectives and stories, and or bring those to the project in, you know, in the writers' rooms.
That's what they say about musicians, is that the first album is your sum total of your life experience and everything you want to say, and then the follow-up album is what happened in the 18 months since then.
I mean, there's so many people say, if you want to be a writer, you know, don't become a writer straight away. Go out and do something different. I remember people saying that to us all the time at film school, and I never did it. I mean, I worked lots of shit jobs, but I knew what I wanted to do, and so it's hard to balance that, I guess. Yeah.
So what were you doing pre-film school? Like, what's been your pathway through the industry?
Yeah. Well, I mean, originally I'm from Dubbo, as Kia knows. I grew up, I didn't know anyone in the entertainment industry. I didn't know anyone who was a writer. I just was really good at English, and I loved English because I got to tell stories. And I think that kind of like went back to when my parents broke up. I used to lie in bed at night and I'd, you know, tell myself like little stories and kind of make sense of the world. And that gave me like a sense of order. So I, you know, moved from Dubbo to Sydney to do my undergraduate degree at UTS in media arts and production. It was a communications degree, and I literally didn't know what I was doing. I just started making short films and stuff like that. And then I finished that, came out of uni and didn't know how to get a job. It was 2008, so it was the GFC. A bunch of really big films had finished here, and I couldn't get any job. Like, I couldn't get a start at all. I was just trying to get. And I ended up going to work. I did like a 6-week unpaid internship for a tiny micro budget Australian film distributor and worked on little film releases. And I did that for like a year and a half, mostly because I was broke. I had no money coming out of uni, and I didn't really know how to go to what's next. And I think midway through that, I was like, okay, I want to be a writer. So I applied to film school, and I was really grateful to get in, because I mean that experience was, it was so invaluable, mostly just because of the amount that you had to write. Like, I think before I got into film school, I was like, oh yeah, I want to be a writer. And then I, you know, write, like I made a couple of short films and I write now and then, but I didn't write with the discipline that you need to write with to be a professional writer. And so, you know, those 2 years that I was at film school, it was just turning in bad drafts, you know, having to pitch stuff that you knew wasn't right. We had really great people come in to talk to us about, you know, their careers and about how to sort of make it. And during that time, my second year at film school, I was mentored by Deborah Oswald, who created Offspring. And that was mostly because I looked around at what was being made in television. I think because I come from feature films, feature film distribution, I knew how hard it was to make a film. And I was from a background where we didn't have a whole heap of money and everyone thought I was nuts trying to be work in this industry anyway. That's like my family. So I was like, okay, I need something where I can actually pay the bills. And TV seemed to be a place where you could tell stories and it wasn't as insane as going out and, you know, making a film. And in terms of what was on TV at the time, like I loved Offspring. I found it, you know, it was hilarious. It was so well written. It was essentially a big rom-com, which was totally up my alley. And Deb was kind enough to be my mentor in my second year. And that was such a great program. Essentially what we had to do was we had to write a project and then we'd, you know, we had to pick something. So I wrote a TV pilot and I go around to Deb's house and we kind of workshop it and talk about what wasn't working. And the thing that I wrote, like, it wasn't good. It was really bad. Like, I'm super embarrassed of it now when I go back and read it. But I think mostly I just got to know Deb. And then coincidentally at the same time, a friend of ours who was in school with us, his partner was Michael Lucas, who was a script producer on Offspring. So I also got to know Michael socially. And then I think the year after film school, I was like working at Mimco 2 days a week and, you know, coming out of film school with like debt and trying to figure out how to, live life. And out of nowhere, Michael Lucas sent me a message. It was on Facebook Messenger. And he said, hey, do you want to come down and learn how to script coordinate on Offspring season 5? Our script coordinator is getting a script. And we just need someone to come in for 3 months. We thought it'd be a good opportunity for you to learn how to do it.
Unreal.
It was so great. And then also in addition to that, he was like, you can just come and live with me if you want. And I was like, that's great, which was so good. And he, which was great because that was kind of like this, it was like a talent escalator program because not only did I get to go to work every day on Offspring and learn how to script coordinate, how to work in the writer's rooms and in the script office. But I also, and I was exposed to such good writers. I mean, they were just really great writers on that show and great producers as well. I also got to go home with Michael at the end of the day and we cooked dinner and we'd talk about what happened and we'd talk about story and we'd watch episodes of TV. And it was kind of like being at film school, being this like kind of film school camp, I guess. So I did that and then I did that for 3 months. And then after that, Imogen Banks asked me if I would script coordinate on Gallipoli, which was the next show for that group of producers that was being made. And that was a completely different experience to Offspring. Gallipoli was, you know, well, it was a TV series which was about war. That was fun. I was really into that. But instead of having lots of different writers, there was just one writer. It was Chris Lee who wrote the whole thing and one director. And so it was a really different experience going into that show. They were essentially shooting it like a feature film as opposed to, you know, lots of different episodes. I did everything to stay on that show. I worked, I ran, I drove actors around. I'm really good friends with the people that worked in production now on who were on that show, but they just didn't really want a script coordinator, I think. They wanted the money for something else. So I was like fighting tooth and nail to stay in there. So I was, you know, I was going and doing the grocery shopping and I was driving cast around and I was, you know, doing all sorts of odds and ends.
It's interesting the, you know, that pathway definitely sounds familiar for a lot of people, that sort of going in via script coordinating and this there was this sort of unspoken understanding that script coordinators, if you hung around long enough, eventually you'd get a script. But I think that almost to me feels like a relic of a time when we had super long running series. So, you know, 22 plus episodes per season, so that, you know, there was bound to be one that would free up. And if you hang around and you know the show inside out, then that might just fall in your lap and that's how you get your break. But you know, as someone who's worked largely in commercial free-to-air television, which is kind of increasingly making less and less drama, how do you see that landscape having changed, and how do you think that is still a viable pathway to kind of script coordinate your way into getting your own episode?
You're absolutely right. It's completely changed. And that is how I got my first script. I was a script coordinator on The Wrong Girl after that. And I tried, you know, fought tooth and nail to try and get a script on that show. And I kept kind of getting told, no, we can't. And then how I got my first script was Judy McCrossan, who created that series. She, you know, it was that thing right at the end of the season, the script was due. By that point, I was sort of writing scenes here and there for Jude. And at the very last minute, she was like, do you want to co-write the script with me? And so I took that opportunity. And you're right, after that, everything changed. Like after that, I was considered a jobbing writer or a drama writer. But before that, but now you're right, it's completely changed. It's really hard to do that. It's because they're, you know, series are shorter runs, and particularly on network television, you know, somewhere like Channel 10 with the changes with, you know, the quota system and stuff like that, they now, I think, essentially just have to make Neighbours and one TV drama, which at the moment is Five Bedrooms. With Seven, it's, you know, they've kind of got Home and Away, and I think this year they've got Us, they've got RFDS. And so there's that, and that's not the way that it used to be. And that run, you know, RFDS is 8 episodes. Ian wrote 3 episodes, co-wrote the other two with Ado Wills and John Bell, and then I wrote the other 3. And so you're right, like there's no opportunity there for someone else on that season anyway. I think, like, I would be really sad if script coordinating was no longer a way in, because I think you learn so much from doing it. You learn how a script office works. It means that I'd seen writers turn in drafts that worked, drafts that didn't, and I'd seen how producers kind of handled those situations. I know, for example, Michael Lucas, who is the creator of is a co-creator of Five Bedrooms, and also has just created a new series for ABC called The Newsreader. The way that he's doing it is he is like every season of that show, he's essentially trying to get a new script coordinator in so that they can learn how the show works. And then he's just started giving writers or script coordinators, you know, a draft or a chance at writing a draft on something that he's writing, so that they still have that way in, because you're right, that doesn't exist anymore. So I think
that's great. That's great to hear he's doing that. You need kind of people that are actively using their position to open those doors for new.
Yeah. So I think it still can happen. I think it takes, it means that, you know, people have to fight really hard for those opportunities for new writers. But I know, you know, in the case of Michael, he and I talk about it all the time, like what a good way in that was, because you do sort of learn, how TV works essentially.
Well, the next big thing was obviously Playing for Keeps, but maybe we'll circle back to that. because I think something that you're saying is about, you know, just about seeing, being in the production office, being in a script office, you see how many things have to go right. And particularly in looking at some of the background for Little Miss Sunshine, Michael Arndt talks a lot about how many times that film nearly died and didn't end up on the screen. So maybe let's have a little chat about Little Miss Sunshine, and then we can circle back to Playing for Keeps, because I'm curious to hear. That was obviously a big leap from writing single episodes on someone else's show to kind of running your own. So, Dave.
Cool. All right. Well, here, let's get the details, the essentials for the script that we got. It's dated October 9, 2003, Little Miss Sunshine, written by Michael Arndt. A family determined to get their young daughter into the finals of a beauty pageant take a cross-country trip in their VW bus. And as you mentioned, Kia, Michael, his background, worked as a reader in his past, was the assistant to Matthew Broderick. And one of the things that was said when he got up to accept his Academy Award was he had to quit his job to finish, to work on Little Miss Sunshine, which is so annoyingly vague, but we'll leave that. Wrote the first draft in May 2000 and then spent a year rewriting it. But I see, Kia, you've also got a detail in there. I didn't hear or read this, that he wrote the first draft in 4 days. That can't be true.
Apparently.
Yeah, so he says.
Didn't he also, after that, though, spend years redrafting and tinkering? But he wrote that first draft in like 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, that's what he's recorded as saying.
The timeline that I got I watched an interview, as he said, he wrote the first draft in May 2000 and then it was sold December 2001.
Yeah.
So, like, well over. Yes.
Fast.
Sold for $250,000, which, you know, I don't know how that, like, in terms of Hollywood screenplays, I imagine that's still in the indie feature script ballpark. But I don't know about you, Claire, but I read that figure and it just makes me want to cry.
I know. Yeah, US feature film money is, I mean, I don't work in features, so I've got no idea. But it's
but that's, like, read, that's the if, budget if, of some Aussie features.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But have either of you read The Big Picture?
No.
Yes. Yeah.
I just have a feeling that this was of the time, and this and those kind of figures. Like, you know, I don't know obviously for sure, but that it just doesn't exist anymore.
Well, certainly spec scripts in general are harder to get away in the US now. If you've got to have IP, it's a book or it's a toy franchise or it's a board game or whatever the hell.
Yeah. Totally. It has to be a brand. There has to be a franchise attached.
So in terms of that 4 days in which he wrote this first draft of the script, obviously, yeah, then a year of rewrites. And I read a great quote from Sorkin the other day that was about, like, you write your script and then when you get to the end and you realize what your movie's about, you go back and you start rewriting your script. And, like, so I think there's definite value in just, and I've become a big fan of this lately, because I got into this habit of just being paralyzed by not being able to move something forward and staring at the blank page. But it's so much easier once you've got something on the page to apply all of the sort of analytic tools that you gather as a screenwriter to figure out why something's not working than to just stare at a blank page. So doing this kind of vomit draft where you just get a terrible version of your story onto a page and then go back and the real work starts in shaping those bits that are not good into something a bit more coherent. Is that, how does that compare to your process, Claire? Are you a vomit draft person or?
I really want to be a vomit draft person and I'm really trying to become that because, I mean, that's actually the last season of, the first season of RFDS. The last show I worked on, that's probably the time that I've rewritten the most. And I think there can be real rigidity as you're coming up that you think, oh, okay, I'm going to do a scene breakdown, then we do a first draft, then I do a second draft, and then I do a third draft, and then, you know, I do a polish and we're done. And I mean, in television anyway. And I've sort of learnt to really just let go and just have fun with redrafting. And I think it's really important to do that. I am trying to write a feature at the moment, actually, just because I never have. And because I had a baby and I was like, that feels like a good use of maternity leave to write a film. But I've just had exactly the same problem where I started, you know, I think I spent like 4 months, not 4 months full time. I mean, 4 months broken time with the baby, but 4 months on the first act, and I just couldn't get past it because I had to make sure it was perfect. And then now I've just kind of let go and just gone all the way to the end. And I'm like, oh, nothing in the first act is going to stick. I've got to go back. But the second act's great, you know?
Mm-hmm.
My friend Evan has a similar sort of feeling to you, it seems, Claire, where because I'm a big fan of The Vomit Draft, Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, total advocate for it, and she writes that literally if you feel like you to keep moving your character needs to say blah 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 for you to keep moving, do it. But he has this attitude that he can't unsee bad writing.
Really?
So he's worried.
Oh no, I forget. I totally.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to tell.
I can't remember what was in the first draft at all.
Yeah.
And very occasionally as well, I reckon you go, well, this is shit, but I'll fix it later.
Yeah.
And then you come back to it and you're like, oh, that's not as shit as I remember. Like, there's a way to make that work.
Yeah, totally. Or you discover things as you go, which is always, you know, worth shooting for.
Yeah. I'll throw this question out to both of you. What do you make of the screenplay overall? Obviously, Academy Award winner, so I think we can all agree it's pretty good. But what stands out to you, Kia?
For me, I mean, we're talking a lot about authenticity and voice before and how valuable that is. And to me, there is such strong voice from the first moments of this screenplay, and that voice comes through in the specificity and the detail that is in the script. Like, just seemingly innocuous choices, like the fact that she serves Sprite with dinner for everyone, or the descriptions of the clothing that someone's wearing, or these little details that just make it so distinct and immediately take it from like generic chaotic family to I know these people, and this guy obviously knows these people, because it's too well observed to just be generic. This is his life in some way. He's drawn this from his own experiences. So yeah, the voice I think is a big thing. And then obviously it's such a character piece and the characters are so beautiful, such a beautiful ensemble of characters who all have their own kind of individual arcs that are perfectly realized.
I mean, for me, with this script, I think what's kind of all the thing that I really admire about it is that everything that's on the page is just there to sort of set up that ending or each of those arcs. It's that you don't kind of go off into something just because, or there's not a bit of detail about character that's there just because. It's all really clearly about the theme and about, you know, those arcs, and also about that ending. It's everything that's on that page is for that reason. And I think, you know, so like when I first got into TV, I'd look at writers who would get their scripts through relatively unscathed, and it was, you know, the thing when it holds together like that, you can't, I guess, pull it apart in some ways. It all needs to be there to make it work. And it's just so restrained as well. It's effortless. Like, you feel like, particularly that first dinner party sequence, you know, you've seen that scene a million times. I think it runs to like 20 pages or something. But in that run, he's able to set up all of those characters to set up the story. And that's what I really admire about it. It looks like he's doing nothing, but he's doing everything.
Yeah, you're right about it being effortless. Like, I sat down and I was like, I'll just read the first 10 pages and then I'll go back and read the rest later. And I looked up and I was like at the end of the first act, page 25 or something, page 30. And you just keep turning because it's so easy
to
read.
Yeah. And I really love that it feels like, in some ways, you know, the whole film feels like in some ways one piece of action. Like, you sort of, they get the call, they decide to go the next day, they stay one night, and then the following day is the performance. And that constraint, I think, really works in its favor. And you feel like you're on this journey with them. And I mean, it's a road trip movie, so that always helps. But yeah.
Yeah.
I do believe that he started with the ending and worked backwards, or just thought knew where he wanted the story to end. Are you still with me? Have I dropped out?
Yes. Okay, yeah, you dropped out for a second, but we got the gist.
Always, as soon as I start
ending.
Talking. Okay, well then I'll just get to the question then. So it started with the ending and worked way backwards. Have either of you ever done that for TV, for anything, for, you know, even a short story?
I'm doing it at the moment for with this film that I'm writing. I had the ending really, really early, and that is probably the reason I'm going to finish it. I remember through high school, you know, writing short stories and teachers being like, you need to have the ending, you need to figure out where you're going. And I always hated that. And now finally, you know, this far into my career, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a really good idea. If you can do that, if you can sort of know where you're going. Yeah. It's really hard though. Sometimes you need the pages to figure it out. But if you figure out the ending before you sit down to write, then that's amazing.
Yeah, I've done it less so. I mean, I guess predominantly working in TV, the idea of an ending is slightly different because it's, yeah, you're always ending on a hook for the next episode or the next season. Something that I'm working on now, the ending is very clear in my mind, but whether that, you know, depending on the fortunes of the series, whether that is the ending at the end of season one or two or eight, like you can kind of keep holding off, but I know what the very final moment of the very end of the show looks like, which is helpful in kind of guiding how the choices that you make.
But just as often you don't know and you're just like, well, look, I'll work it out. Is that more scary to do it that way?
I think with film, yes. I think it's really hard to do it. With TV, I think it's really handy to have a really vague idea of where you're going. And often, I mean, with television, the great privilege that you have is that often you're, you know, working on that last block and they've kind of got assemblies or they've got, you know, those first few episodes. So you can start to watch the series and then you can change the end based on what you're seeing, because so often, you know, what actors bring to it, what their chemistry is like, you know, how the story comes across is different to how you intention it in the writing as well. So I think being flexible in TV is really great. But yeah, with film, it's kind of like, you know, it's your lighthouse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's get into the first 10 pages properly. I'll just summarize them for the first 10 pages of Little Miss Sunshine. The first 10 introduces the family: Olive, Richard, Cheryl, Frank, Dwayne, and Grandpa. Does he have a name, or is he only ever referred to as Grandpa?
I'm pretty sure he's only referred to as Grandpa.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Olive is obsessed with beauty pageants. Richard is pushing his 9-step self-help program. Cheryl picks up her brother Frank from the hospital following a suicide attempt. Grandpa snorts heroin in the bathroom, and Dwayne works out in his bedroom and reads Nietzsche. The family gather to have dinner, which is where the inciting incident occurs, when we find out that Olive has been accepted into the state finals of the Little Miss Sunshine competition. I'm going to jump straight to page 7. This is just a little exercise I'd like to throw at both of you. So Richard walks in and checks his messages to see if Stan Grossman has called. But the only message is the one about Olive being accepted to Little Miss Sunshine. So very 2006, right before iPhones and, you know, text messaging was still around. How do you reckon that, I just want to give this exercise to you both, how would that inciting incident play out in 2021? What just your first thought idea to withhold it to that moment?
That's a really good question. Because I mean, people leave me voicemails and I delete them. I don't listen to them. Mm. I never listen to them properly. I just call them back. So it's such a great moment, and it shows you, you know, what that family think, like whether that family's priorities are. Yeah, Wilkins, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, it's a really interesting inciting incident, and he actually does it quite cleverly because the inciting incident when Olive realizes that she's been invited, that's kind of the inciting incident, but that happens
on page 20.
Pretty late. Yeah, so page 20, but he buys himself a bit of time to get the audience to fall in love with the characters by having Dad hear the message, not really understand it, ignore it, but the audience then has the anticipation of like, is he just going to ignore that? When's Olive going to find out about this? So it's really cleverly withheld. But I guess a 2021 version, I could imagine, because what the message is that the previous Little Miss Sunshine winner or whatever it was, the person who won the pageant that Olive came runner-up in was on diet pills, was using diet pills, yeah. So has been disqualified. So I guess you could maybe play it out on social media in real time, like someone sees on Instagram that someone, you know, someone's been exposed as having taken diet pills and they've been cancelled and it's all, you know, happens much more in real time. And they might call the beauty pageant to be like demanding, I don't know.
That's pretty good. I think that's the best. I mean, I was like email. I was so bored with my own ideas.
Your Apple Watch pings.
TikTok would have to make some sort of appearance at some point.
That's what it would be. Yeah, Olive would be doing a TikTok, and then she'd see in her feed.
Totally.
Or Cheryl would see in the feed.
Yeah, Olive would be doing a TikTok. No, Grandpa Olive would be doing it.
What is it? Fucking diet pills? And then that's how... Kia, what have you got to say about the first 10?
Just the efficiency with which it is set up. Like within the first 5 pages, you've met 6 characters and you have a pretty clear idea of who they are, or at the very least, their sort of their want or their longing, or and within that want and longing, the conflict that is clearly going to come with it. Like you introduce us to an 8-year-old girl who is desperate to be a beauty queen, but she is not, you know, traditional beauty queen appearance. So you already go, okay, I know who this character is. I know what they want. And I can see the inherent conflict in that. And that's like a 30-second scene. And he does that for 6 main characters. You got a guy who wants to kill himself and he ends up being babysat by his sister in this chaotic family home. You see a grandpa who's clearly a drug addict, but he's 80, so you know that's not going to pan out that well for someone in their 80s to be snorting heroin all the time. So just these little introductions are so brief but can tell you so much about the characters. And 5 pages in, you're like, I love this family.
Yeah. And although I feel like I have to say, I feel like Cheryl's really hard done by.
Definitely.
All the characters are banging, and then Cheryl is a woman who's looking after everyone, and I'm just like, Cheryl, come on, what about yourself? Where are you?
Yeah, she's treated very much as the glue of the family rather than having her own wants and arcs, and
it's such a
lazy mum thing to fall back on, of like, she's just the one who lives to serve her family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like if I'm going to ever criticize Michael Arndt, that's like the only thing I could ever criticize him for. But I think as well, you know, because she's the only woman, you know, there's Olive, but because she's the only woman, you feel it really, really strongly. But you are following her for a lot of those first 10 pages. You're following her in action. She's kind of connecting everyone.
At that point, you kind of think she's the protagonist of the film, I think.
Yeah, she does sort of fade into the background, particularly the further the story goes on. What else, first 10 wise?
I mean, I think Keir's kind of touched on it, but the other thing that I think he does so well is just, you know, you kind of get a scene to set up every character, and within that scene, like, it's you know, it's really basic kind of save the cat stuff. It's like, why do I love this character? And you kind of see, and in every scene he's sort of telling you that really they're a loser, like that Olive is not going to be a beauty queen. She doesn't have what it takes. With Richard, you know, you come back and you see that the classroom, there's nobody there. He's clearly a loser. I think that's one of the things that I love about this opening as well, is that within that amount of time, you just kind of, you're like, oh, I feel for you because you're not as cool as you think you are.
Yeah, it's a big, like, I think it's helpful that they don't go too far into the program, his program. They keep it vague, which I think is helpful because I imagine, like, coming up with a fake self-help program, you sort of would need to actually come up with a self-help program to then give to the character.
I mean, most of his self-help program through the film is just him telling people not to think like a loser, essentially.
I know.
Don't give up.
Yeah.
That's where it comes from, doesn't it? It was Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah. He heard Arnold Schwarzenegger saying something about,
I hate losers.
There are winners. Yeah, I hate losers. There are winners and there's losers, and I hate losers. And that's where it comes from. And, I feel like that message is so clear through the film. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, because the only one who's not besides Cheryl, who is just underserved and is there to sort of facilitate everyone else, the only character who's not buying into that is Grandpa. He's the one who's like, fuck it, I don't care about winning or losing, I'm doing drugs and having a good time.
And he's so clearly, you know, that mentor character. He's and that's why they kill him midway through, isn't it? Because you know, they've all got to learn that on their own, and but that voice is so important through it's really a debate, isn't it, about that point, and that voice is so important in film.
I think that's a really good point, is that there is a clear dramatic thesis to this film. There's a hypothesis stated within the first two pages of Richard being like, this is how the world is, winners and losers. And then every one of those characters tests and pushes against that hypothesis until you arrive at your climax where, you know, the writer, Michael Arndt, gives his answer to, you know, he disproves the Richard's hypothesis, basically, and that's his worldview that he's... He does this great talk about endings, actually, Michael Arndt, that you can find on the internet, about, you know, how an ending brings together the external stakes and the philosophical stakes and the internal stakes all in this one moment where, and that's where you create the meaning of your movie, where you go, okay, we've been testing out this thesis the entire way, but here's what I think, here's my view of the world.
Absolutely, yeah. He does a great one on beginnings as well. He's a really generous screenwriter in talking about his process and craft and,
Cool. Who, Claire, who do you think is the antagonist of the film, and is it set up in the first 10 pages?
The antagonist of the film, for me anyway, is Richard because, he's the protagonist. The antagonist of the film, that's such a good question. I'm like, is there one? My God, the protagonist is Richard. He's the one that changes. He's the one who has a really clear thesis, and at the end of the film, he changes. But an antagonist is it that? My God, here's me trying to figure out story on the fly. I'm looking straight at Keir, and I'm like, I swear we studied this film. did we? Is it? But I mean,
maybe. Yeah,
what he's up against is his own failure. That's
an interesting
one. That's really what's against him. He can't. Stan Grossman. Maybe Stan Grossman's his antagonist because he's the guy that's going to tell him that. I don't know.
Is it possible that the thesis of the film, the theme of there are only winners and losers, that itself, that concept, is the antagonist?
Well, it's like that's what's getting debated, I guess. Like that's the whole way through the film. That's what's debated. Grandpa has an opinion. Richard has an opinion. I don't know.
Because what Richard overcomes is the feeling that of needing to be a winner or a loser.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I think something you're touching on, Dave, is that it's almost like the forces of society, you know, telling little girls that they have to be pretty and look a certain way. You know, those are all sort of external forces of conflict. But, it's almost like each sequence has its own antagonist. It's like the cop that pulls them over, and then it's in the third act, it's like the judges and all the stage mums are the antagonists.
Yeah.
But otherwise they're sort of each other's. It's the family dynamic. It's the interpersonal antagonism between them.
Totally.
But there's not like a big boss that they have to defeat at the end.
No.
Yeah, that must be real. That, I imagine that's very hard to pull off.
It is really hard to pull off. Yeah.
A lot easier when you have like just a super villain who's trying to destroy the earth, and it's like kill the bad guy and save the day, and easy, done.
Yeah, done. When it's something that's inside you. I mean, when it's about your own change, that's the way that you view the world is fundamentally problematic.
What would be the next 10 pages you would suggest? So you get the first 10 pages to hook the reader, and then you hand over another couple of pages to really drive it home. Which ones would you pick? And this doesn't have to literally be 10 pages. It can be a scene, can be a sequence, can be a page, can be one piece of dialogue.
I think the great thing with this film, and one of the reasons I think it's such a good beginning, is I think you could go straight to the climax and it would make sense, because you know who Richard is and you know what he thinks about the world. So for him to go straight to him watching Olive and that Little Miss Sunshine pageant, to see her start to do that dance, you know automatically, you know, what he's thinking and why it's problematic for him. So yeah, I would go straight to the climax, straight to the dance, straight to the horror of Richard watching Olive do that dance on stage, and I think it would totally work.
That's such a great point. I wonder if that is true of a lot of great films, that if you went first act to third act, you would still feel some sense of catharsis.
Well, I feel like that's what Michael Arndt always says about ending, that first act should mirror like the third act, and it's really clear and clean and perfectly done in this film.
I think my next 10 would be the ice cream diner scene. I love this scene so much, and it's kind of, if Olive is the sort of wide-eyed innocent who is, she's a blank canvas in some ways for this dramatic thesis of the film, and everyone's trying to impose their worldview on her, and that scene sums it up so beautifully, where she wants to eat all the ice cream and Grandpa's going, you know what, you should eat ice cream, like, life's too short, eat all the ice cream you want. And then Richard's kind of going, yeah, but, you know, you don't want to get fat because you're not going to win any beauty pageants if you just eat ice cream all the time. And everyone's trying to impose, and you can see Olive just trying to, like, she really wants to eat that ice cream, and she eventually is like, no, I want to be a winner. I want, like, Dad to be proud of me. And it's heartbreaking to see this little girl's sense of self be squashed by her dad's fucked up view of the world. And then when the rest of the family rally together and order ice cream and go like, this is so delicious, like, I'm sure, I bet, you know, you're really missing out, Olive, and everyone rallies to be like, just eat the ice cream, that's what life's about, eating the ice cream.
And I love that scene because it's so well observed. Like, I feel like we've all had a Richard, like, I don't know, certainly growing up definitely had a Richard in my life, but yeah, it was like, sort of say these like kind of things that you don't quite understand at that age, but you know that it's bad, and yeah, feel responsible for it.
Must mentionables. You can't talk about Little Miss Sunshine without talking about what? The first thing I've written down. Anyone read Thus Spoke the Zarathustra? Has anyone read that book? No.
No.
Is that what Dwayne's reading?
I'm not a student of Nietzsche.
And got anything here? Anything you need to talk about? I feel like we talked.
It's got to be one of the most iconic film vehicles of all time, up there with the Ghostbusters car and the Batmobile and stuff like that. That yellow combi van or whatever it is so iconic.
Do you guys remember the Academy Awards from that year? Hugh Jackman hosted, and they did the whole shadow puppet thing, summing up all the movies that were nominated. And when they did the Volkswagen van, very cool. That's another thing worth looking up on
that. And also, I think, like, for screenwriters, this is the film that launched Michael Arndt. Like, I don't know, he's had such an incredible career, and he's done.
And his path, like, his journey to that point is one of those ones that, like, any screenwriter who's just trying to hang in there, it's such a, like, yes, of just, like, it could happen at any moment. Like, if you just write that one bad screenplay, your whole life could change.
That was the other thing. He was working as an assistant to Matthew Broderick, and then I think he'd written, like, a bunch of films, and they're all terrible. And then that's why he wrote this in 3 days, because he was the end of his period that he'd allowed himself to write, and he was like, oh, I've got to write something. And yeah, this was like the last ditch, I'm going to be a screenwriter attempt, and yeah, he nailed it.
Hail Mary.
Yeah.
And he also said that, like, I was writing all these stories where people were dying at the end, and I just decided to write something happy, something with a really happy ending.
Yeah, it's a good ending.
And we ended up with
this film was before, like, Steve Carell was big, you know, like, I think that's incredible. And such a great moment in time for so many of those actors,
I've got a great quote here from Michael Arndt, which, and I'd love to tie this back to getting a little bit of your Playing for Keeps experience, Claire, but... So he says, from my perspective, the difference between success and failure was razor thin and depended to a terrifying degree upon chance, serendipity, and all manner of things beyond my control. 1,000 things could have gone wrong in the 5 years it took to turn Little Miss Sunshine into a movie, any one of which could have destroyed the project. And then he goes on to talk about, you know, it was just this perfect combo of the right producers. He got the right agents who showed it to the right producers, who took it to the right cast, right directors, right distributors. You know, so many things have to go right. And this is the sort of the constant heartbreak of screenwriting, is that, you know, things are so close and then they fall over, or the project that you're in love with doesn't go, but then the thing you sort of wrote on the side does, and you're like, okay, I've got to, you know, learn to love this. So can you talk a little bit about your transition from, I guess it would have been The Wrong Girl, to how playing for Keeps came about? Because that was sort of a huge baptism of fire, as I understand it. It was just like, here, run this show.
Yeah, totally. So what happened was I'd written on the second season of The Wrong Girl as well. And I'd also come back and written on the last season of Offspring as well. So I'd sort of done those last those shows for 10. And Rick Mayer, who's the head of drama at Channel 10, I'm sure it was a perfect storm of, like, nobody else was available and he liked me as well. And, you know, he had an idea where he wanted to do a show about footballers' wives, AFL footballers' wives, and I was asked if I wanted to kind of put it together, a room, and come up with a pitch. And that was, you know, that was a pretty incredible experience, because, you know, I was like, I think I'd written maybe 4 scripts, maybe for 10, and that was it. And 10 were interested in hearing pitch. So I got Christine Bartlett, who's a much more experienced writer than me, in a room with me and another guy by the name of Jamie Brown, and we brainstormed a series. And I, like, first of all, I don't know anything about AFL at all. I grew up in Dubbo, where strong rugby league people. And also I think like when I would think about footballers' wives, I'm Olive watching Little Miss Sunshine. Like, I'm, you know, the chubby kid who's like, it just wasn't my world. Like, this was glitz and they wanted glitz and glamour and, you know, beautiful ladies doing beautiful things. And I was like, how do I, you know, put myself in that world? Because it felt so foreign to me. And that's kind of how we came up with my pitch going in, was essentially, you know, this character Paige, who was a version of me. You know, if she happened to go out with a guy who happened to be an AFL footballer, and she sort of got transported into this world of glitz and glamour and supermodel type people, you know, how would she sort of fit in, and how would she react? And you know, going back to the thematic of winners and losers, and, you know, are you cool or are you not? Social inclusion, like, that's what it was always about for me. So we did that room. Rick came into the room. We sort of loosely pitched him what we were thinking, but we hadn't written anything. And I think I was at a doctor's appointment, and Bob Campbell, who was a producer who was at Screen Time, who's now retired, he called me and he's like, this has never happened in my career before. You know, the show's up. And I still had the pitch, like, half written on my computer. And I was like, oh, okay, right. But what if they don't like what we're doing? And he's like, doesn't matter, we're doing it. Like, we're going to start shooting next year. And I was just like, oh, good. So I then had the pressure of having to go and write a pilot for a show that was already commissioned, that I didn't know if, you know, producers or 10 would like. So I wrote a pilot. The first draft, I think Rick was like, what are you doing? But this doesn't work, which was, you know, I think a huge testament that I felt like I could fail to him. And then the second draft I wrote, and he was happy with, so it was great. Luckily, it didn't go on any longer than that. I'm sure I would have got fired. But, yeah, so then we had this incredibly short time to shoot it, to kind of get it happening, to shoot it. And I'd never script produced at that point. And so it was kind of this do or die moment of just trying to get the scripts written, trying to get it through network, trying to, you know, it was the duck paddling furiously underwater, but trying to remain calm.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's like, yeah, the two kind of takeaways from that story for me are that you needed to find your own way into that world. Like, you got given a brief, but then you're like, you can't write a show when you can't connect to something in it. So you invented a character and a way into that world that was representative of you and your experience, which I think is so smart.
Also a good conduit for the audience who doesn't know. Most people totally. Aren't glamorous wives and girlfriends of AFL players.
And the other thing I think, you know, I guess is just that it will look different for everyone, but just as Michael Arndt's Little Miss Sunshine story, you know, how that came about, how many things had to line up. You know, in your case, it was knowing someone who liked your work, who had an idea, who took a chance on you. Like, so many things had to come together at the right moment in time for you to get that opportunity. So that's one Hollywood example and one local example for aspiring writers of how, you know, it can come in many surprising ways.
Totally. And I think the other thing that really surprised me was, you know, like how steadfast Rick's belief that I could do it was and screen time, because not once, you know, did they sort of treat me as they probably should have done, that I was someone who'd only written 4 episodes of two different series and had never script produced a series. They were just like, yeah, no, you're going to do this and you can do it and get it done, essentially. But I mean, right at the end, that was madness trying to write script. We weren't quite, you know, you hear stories about writers sitting next to the split and trying to write scripts and stuff like that. It wasn't that bad at all. But for me, who had never done it before, it was pretty, terrifying. I thought that I was, you know, going to really mess up. And afterwards I was like, oh, I think maybe this is what TV looks like a lot of the time. I think it is maybe, you know, quite...
clinging on for dear life.
Yeah, clinging on for dear life. And then you kind of make something. You're like, oh, that's good.
Do you know why was it so quickly greenlit? Was it just who the powers that be loved the one-sentence pitch and said, yes, we need that show?
Yeah, that's what it was. It was all about, I just inspired them that much. No, it's going to go to air next year. We've got these gaps. You know, what are we going to announce? And they decided that was a show they wanted to make the following year. So they announced it. And, you know, and they had the team. They had Screen Time, who were a very established production company, who, you know, had a track record of delivering shows. So they had that, and they just went, let's go for it. I mean, I think in Australian TV, you kind of get both ends of the stick, or I think any TV, you get the stuff that's made really fast, and because, you know, it's got to go to air, or there's something they're trying to hit, or there's a slot, and then you've got the stuff that you work on for like 5 years and never gets up. And, you know, I have those shows as well, and it's definitely, even though it's terrifying, it's much more fun to be shooting and not really knowing where the story's going. And
when you got 2 seasons and now you're an Australian television heavy hitter.
I don't know about a heavy hitter, but yeah, I'm working, which is really nice. And it's, you know, it's hard, as you said, Keir, it's like hard to get those breaks now, and I'm so grateful that I got a break. And you just gotta keep going and trying to get in.
Yeah.
Any way you can. And just like quickly on that, yes, I came in through script coordinating, but I did a bunch of other stuff to try and get in. Like we did, with a couple of guys that we went to film school with, we did Fresh Blood for ABC iView, which I produced and co-wrote. And that could have just as easily been the thing that, you know, happened, but it didn't. And I just kept writing my own stuff. And eventually one of those ways.
Something's got to give.
Opened up. Something's got to give, but you just got to do everything.
If you're good is the sort of caveat to all of that. It's like persistence is great as long as you are good.
I think tenacity is really important. I think so, yeah.
Let's finish the show on just recommendations. What are you watching or reading right now?
I am, you know, it's like having a baby. My baby's almost 6 months old. And I think we've watched maybe 2 shows in that whole period because it's so hard to watch TV. But I'm just in the middle of Wakefield, and I think it's really incredible. And anyone who hasn't watched Wakefield should go out and watch it on the ABC. My husband's also a psychologist, so, you know, watching it with him is always really interesting because I get to ask him questions and stuff. mental health. Yeah. Oh,
very interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah. There you go. That's something to put on the viewing list. Claire Phillips, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about your life and career and the amazing Little Miss Sunshine. Thank you so much.
We got so close, Dave. Sorry. Do your wrap up again.
Phillips, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with Kia and I about your life and career and, of course, the amazing Little Miss Sunshine. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Kia. We'll see you next time. Fade to black. The end.